This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 8:55 a.m. Good morning, Leila, Inez, and Alice.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Good
how
morning.
Are you, Priya?
Oh, how am I? I'm doing okay. How's everyone else?
I'm good. I'm happy to be back.
Yeah.
It's Leila here.
And Leila's back. Woo woo.
So I'm back, but also it is Gurrawong season and which is aka kangaroo apples, which are also back.
Kangaroo apples are back.
If anyone's been keeping track of the little green fruits, that will be red soon.
I don't feel like I have any. How do I keep an eye out for
You'll
apples?
Find a lot around creeks or okay. waterways.
Ah, good to know.
But luckily I have a friend with some in their backyard.
Nice.
So that's how I keep track of it.
And there are plenty of very full nests around everywhere. I had to pick up a noisy miner chick that had fallen into the middle of the bike path the other day. I don't know what's happened to it, but I did, after an extended ordeal, put it back in the tree. I was like, this could be such the worst pet ever. but absolutely nobody who I raised that idea with encouraged me to hand rear it. So we have a very full show today, an amazing lineup of speakers. Do you want to kick us off?
Yes. So first we'll be joined by Bridget Dunn, who's a senior lawyer at Youth Law, who joins us to discuss the adult time for youth crime bills that are being rushed through Parliament. Now, Bridget works in early intervention crime programs aiming at helping young people involved in the justice system. She's an experienced criminal lawyer who joins us to talk about how it's really unjust. And then we are joined by Professor Kate Fitzgibbon and Matt Tyler to discuss the Lily James coronial inquest and how the government needs to act on femicide and domestic violence. Now, Kate is a professor at Monash University and leading international expert on domestic violence and sexual violence. And Matt Tyler is also one of Australia's leading advocates focused on improving the lives of children and young people as executive director of the Men's Project at Jesuit Social Services. Now, this segment will discuss themes of femicide, of domestic violence, and of technology and stalking and coercive control, which can be distressing to some listeners. So if you want to skip that, you can join us for the next episode after that.
Yeah, and after that, we are joined by one of this year's Eureka Medal recipients, Vasalia Govender, who was awarded the medal last week in recognition of her long-term advocacy work as a founder of the Injured Workers Support Team, or IWST. IWST is a grassroots community network providing human-centred support to workers navigating Victoria's workplace injury compensation system. And today, Vasalia will join us to share a bit more about IWST's most recent campaign.
And then we'll have Maurice from Resident Frequency Studio live in studio with us to discuss Rave for the Towers, a day of music and food by the community for the community in solidarity with the 44 towers facing eviction on Friday the 19th of December.
Amazing. And just to round it out, finally, we'll be joined by Kristen O'Connell, who's a spokesperson for the Anti-Poverty Centre, to break down the second report by the Commonwealth Ombudsman in its investigation into the Targeted Compliance Framework, otherwise known as, quote, mutual obligations, end quote, where welfare recipients are subjected to a regime of compulsory activities in order to access Social Security payments. This is a pretty scathing report and follows up an earlier report that was released in August this year. So I'm keen to unpack that with Kristen. We're only seeing the increased criminalization of people on Social Security, and this interview will infuriate you to see just how arbitrary these punishments are. But stay tuned. We will be with you all the way until 8:30 a.m. on 3CR 855 a.m.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 11th of December. The Albanese government's social media ban came into effect yesterday and has drawn sharp criticism from mental health and youth welfare experts, as well as cyber safety specialists, who say that the ban will harm vulnerable young people by cutting them off from support networks. Critics also warn that the ban normalises surveillance for young people and will be difficult to implement effectively due to privacy problems and inaccuracies of age assurance technology. Digital Rights Watch are urging communities and families to support young people affected by the ban, saying many rely on social media for mental health support. In other news, the Northern Territory government has blocked United Nations human rights inspectors from accessing prisons, youth detention centres and police watchhouses, despite federal assurances that all jurisdictions would cooperate with the inspections as part of the United Nations anti-torture protocols. Advocates say that the territory government's reaction undermines human rights obligations and follows damning findings of overcrowded, unhygienic, inhumane conditions in Northern Territory detention facilities.
In other news this week, the Victorian government's formal apology to First Nations people, which was delivered this week, is being criticised as little more than a symbolic gesture, with First Nations people and advocates pointing out that the state simultaneously passed laws that will worsen First Nations over-representation in prisons. Labor said the apology has come out of the treaty negotiation process and that many Victorians did not know about the extent of the harm done to First Nations people at the hands of the colonial state. Critics also pointed out that the apology lacked bipartisan support, with the Liberal opposition voting against it because it mentions treaty, fueling concerns the gesture may not translate into lasting change. Also in headlines, Victorian environment groups and local community organisations have condemned the state government's decision to proceed with the two new petroleum exploration licence tenders in Gippsland and the offshore Otway Basin, saying the projects will threaten marine ecosystems, groundwater, and are a counter to the state's climate targets. Friends of the Earth have accused the Allan government of ignoring strong public opposition to further gas exploration and for prioritising industry interests over evidence that points to the urgent need to transition away from gas.
Also in headlines, with a note for First Nations listeners, this headline contains mention of a First Nations person who has died. A Western Australian coroner has found the death of 16-year-old Cleveland Dodd in youth detention in 2023 was predictable and preventable, and has recommended the urgent closure of the Unit 18 facility. Cleveland was held in extreme isolation for up to 22 hours a day in the months leading up to his death, in conditions described in the coronial inquiry as inhumane and degrading. Cleveland's mother, Nadine Dodd, said, quote, "While I hope that Cleveland's death and Coroner Urquhart's findings and recommendations will lead to the change required to prevent other children from suffering the way my son did, it depends on a massive fundamental shift in the Department of Justice's approach to youth justice, which is yet to be seen." End quote.
And finally, in headlines, despite serious concerns expressed by groups including Care Not Cruelty and Vixen Workers and widespread public opposition, City of Port Phillip councillors last night voted to pass local law changes that will punish rough sleepers in the area. These law changes, which passed with 6 votes in favour and 3 against, will unfairly target people sleeping rough by designating no camping zones and functioning to disband groups and remove their belongings. Care Not Cruelty have vowed to continue to challenge these laws and to fight for the dignity and humanity of rough sleepers. And you can follow them on Instagram for updates on the ongoing campaign by heading to care.not.cruelty. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 11th of December, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
Slacker Radio. Say goodbye to the work week.
With Jordan.
And Tilda.
Anti-work.
Anti-poverty.
Anti-fascist.
Pro-worker.
Pro-union.
Pro-guitar.
5:30 p.m. every first and third Friday of the month. Live on 3CR Community Radio.
Come on down to Geelong in January 2026 for the Having a Say conference. It's the most fun you'll ever have all year.
It's a call to arms and the ability to mix it up with ministers in our sector and our voices to be heard.
But we also have come and try activities, a talent show, a dinner disco, and it's a lot of fun. So get online www.valid.org.au and register your interest.
A 3CR supporter.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast, 8:55 a.m. And now for our first interview, I'll be talking to Bridget Dunn, who is a senior lawyer at Youth Law, who joins me to discuss the adult time for youth crime bills that are being rushed through Parliament. And Bridget works in early intervention crime programs aimed at helping young people involved in the justice system and is an experienced criminal lawyer and human rights advocate who's worked across this continent and internationally. Thanks so much for joining us here today, Bridget.
Thanks for having me.
Could you first start off by telling us why these adult time for violent crime youth justice sentencing reforms are and why they're being rushed through Parliament?
So the adult time for adult crime sentencing reforms were pushed through Parliament last week. They were tabled and voted on and finalised within a day, so it was a real rush to the finish line. The laws basically create higher penalties for some offences, some serious offences, for children aged 14 to 17. So it creates additional offences relating to possessing a knife whilst committing another offence, like a robbery, for example. But it also means that children, instead of being sentenced in the children's court, which is the appropriate venue, will be sent up to the county court to appear in front of a county court judge, which, in addition to there being a higher penalty, effectively means that they're much more likely to be sentenced to a term of imprisonment.
Yep. Having these rushed through in about a day is horrific, and knowing that in family court and children's court they have expert, you know, magistrates and people that work there that are able to support children. What are some of the challenges when it does get moved up to county court in terms of protection for children and their and families and the way that they engage in this system?
Yeah, I mean, the children's court is designed specifically to be more of a therapeutic space. So it recognises that, you know, children are children. They're less developmentally mature. They have additional needs. They're probably pretty frightened to be there regardless of what's happened before. And they have additional psychological and personal needs. The children's court has trained magistrates who are experienced with dealing with children, particularly recognising their developmental needs. It also has a range of other supports available for children and their families, including the Specialist Children's Court Clinic, which is a specialised, specific psychological and psychiatric support service that can provide expert reports to the court. In the county court, none of that exists. So there are no children safe cells, for example, if a child is in custody. The judges are not specifically trained in relation to the needs of children and their development. There's no additional support services available, and there's no equivalent of the children's court clinic or anything like that. So it's just a really hostile adult environment, and it makes the children in that environment even more vulnerable to the trauma and potential consequences of what's going to happen to them there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think from a lot of the reporting I feel like a lot of what is being unsaid is a lot of the time the people who are being involved in, you know, or unfairly like over-policed are communities of colour and First Nations people. And having that on top of the already fraught human rights abuses that are occurring in all of across this continent on youth jails and detention centres. And then now we have another bill that is, you know, really focusing on youth crime and furthering, you know, potential human rights implications. Could you talk to us about how this completely deviates from our obligations as Australia under international law for the rights of children?
So Australia is a signatory to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and those obligations are part of our international commitment to the framework that provides traditional support for children, recognising that children are particularly vulnerable within our community. That requires Australia and Victoria as part of Australia to put the best interests of children as a primary consideration. And it also requires us to make some fairly fundamental decisions around whether or not imprisonment or detention is appropriate for children, whether it should be the last resort and for the shortest appropriate time, and also to promote, like, it requires us to promote the physical and psychological recovery of children and their reintegration into society. I think recognising that, you know, children aren't committing crimes because they're bad. They're committing crimes because, or they're engaging in behaviour because they are being let down by the community that is meant to support them. So no one wakes up in the morning and is like, this is going to be gnarly. They are struggling against often neglect, poverty, racism, a lack of adequate mental health support, a lack of supported schooling, a whole range of things, inadequate housing, pressures at home, exposure to violence at an early age. So we are really letting these kids down when we pile onto them on top of the difficulties that they're already facing by failing to recognise our obligations to them and their human rights. And this bill really rides roughshod over all of that.
Yeah. And, you know, I firmly do believe that a lot of children's behaviour is communication, given their circumstances and, you know, what's happened to them and around them. And as you said, we are letting them down and just putting them in prison without support or even, you know, therapeutic programs is really difficult. And I'm wondering, you know, from your experience working with young people, what have you found is the benefits of, the therapeutic programs instead of going to prison?
I mean, I think prison should be the last resort for everyone, regardless of their age, but particularly for children, because their brains are still so malleable and they're still in such a vulnerable position. And we find in our practice, where we work alongside social workers and we make sure that we're trying to provide really wraparound supports, that with support, with being able to kind of provide early identification of issues like mental health problems, trying to kind of look at the child as a whole person and the kind of web of connections that they have in terms of their family, their community, school, what are the different pressure points. There is the possibility of making a lot of progress in even a short amount of time for that young person, and that can really help bring them out of the criminal justice system early so that they are not only not engaging in, you know, difficult and potentially threatening behaviours or scary behaviours, I guess, for the community, but that they are also then, like, able to kind of thrive in their own space, you know, that we're trying to make this engagement with the justice system as short as possible so that they can heal and continue to work and to continue to engage with support and move on with their lives, because you don't want your life to be over when you're 15, you know, like going to prison at 15. Prisons are schools for crime. They set people up for disruption, disconnection, violence and pain. And that when they come out of prison, whatever age they are, they bring that with them into the community, and it creates really harmful cycles that it's really difficult to help people escape from. So early intervention and providing therapeutic avenues and providing supports as early as possible is really crucial. crucial to giving these kids a chance to thrive.
Yep. Giving the kids a chance to thrive is so important because, you know, in so many communities and, you know, particularly a lot of young people of colour, they often can be targeted, from such a young age, and then, you know, for crimes, for poverty or just communication, explaining this can be really hard because then you get into, from primary school and then, you know, to 15 and then having like further implications for the rest of your life. Could you talk a little bit about, what it does mean if somebody does get charged at 15 for one of these, you know, so-called youth crimes, and then what impact this can have like on housing, on their relationships, on their disconnection? Because I presume also these sentences are going to be much bigger than, you know, a therapeutic program available to the children's court.
Yeah, so what the new sentencing structure that's been put in place through these laws basically funnels children towards prison at a much faster and earlier rate than they would otherwise previously have been exposed. So it really takes a number of rungs out of the ladder, if I could put it that way, and it's just really skipping a number of steps that used to be in place to try and prevent children from going to prison. And instead we're kind of, now the laws are designed to sweep people in as early as possible is perhaps a blunt but not inaccurate way of putting it. So that means that children will miss out on a number of opportunities for intervention that they would previously have. So there's many fewer chances for them to engage with support or to get adequate mental health treatment outside of prison before they go into remand or to detention. And once a child is in detention, they're cut off from family support beyond limited visits. Often there is not suitable detention facilities close to where people's families are, so they may not see their families at all.
Yep.
Travel to Melbourne is too challenging. And they are put in with a lot of other traumatised, troubled young people who are also cut off from community, cut off from family, not going to school, not seeing their GP, and who are in this really brutal, policed, carceral environment. So it's a real recipe for trauma, it's a recipe for violence, and it's forces kids together who would be much better off at home or in a community that can support them where there's at least a possibility that they can make change. Not a lot of change happens in detention. You're just put away, even with the best of intentions and programs in custody, it's still a really traumatic and intense and violent environment. And so coming out from that at whatever time they are able to, they then have to start again in terms of reconnecting with community and family that may not be there for them. They have to figure out what to do in relation to all the education that they've missed only been able to do fragments of whilst inside. Yeah. They are probably hugely traumatised and not able to access adequate mental health supports for that experience. And their social group now is the people that they were inside with. So it creates this kind of stepping stone towards greater involvement in offending behaviour because there's such a disruption to their lives and it cuts them off from all effective support.
Yeah.
I say that knowing that there are lots of great programs that are really trying to help and reach these young people when they're coming out of custody to give them as much support as possible, but it's so difficult and you're starting from you're trying to rebuild from zero basically. So it's a really, really challenging situation and it doesn't make the community safer because we're cutting these young people off at the knees in the sense of not giving them the opportunity to engage and get support when they need it and instead kind of dropping them in it and then expecting them to do better, which I think is really unfair.
It is unfair, and I think there's just the nature of, you know, removing people away from their families, from their communities, and then putting so much admin and travel and cost makes the, you know, relationship as difficult as it can be, regardless of the best intentions. And it's clear that this is so incompatible with the human rights of children. What can young people do, or our listeners do, to really try to revert this, or support youth law's efforts as well?
Well, I wish there was an easy answer to that. Unfortunately, the bill is in, so the bill is law, so that's really difficult. I think there is still a chance to write to your MP, call a lobby group, say this is really upsetting and disappointing and really goes against our obligations, and we want a true commitment to early intervention and to diverting children out of the justice system, and that, you know, to just express that this is a failure on the part of the Victorian government to properly commit to our Human Rights Charter and to Australia's obligations under the Convention on the Rights of the Children. We are considering whether or not a legal challenge is possible to the laws, but that is still at an early stage. We've received some really excellent advice in relation to that, and we're considering our options. But I think in terms of supports that people in the community can concentrate on, think about your local Aboriginal-controlled organisations and any youth programs that they might have, the Centre for Multicultural Youth that does amazing work, particularly reaching out to young people of colour who are particularly at risk under these new laws. So any of those kinds of organisations that try to lift up youth, connect them, engage with them, provide them with their therapeutic options, I mean, that's where we have to put all our support now, I think.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you so much. I mean, yeah, having young people even face life imprisonment and no chance of, you know, therapeutic rehabilitation is, yeah, really scary. But thank you for helping us break it down. And there's so many supports that are still available. And, you know, and really, yeah, commending all the effort that Youth Law has been doing as well.
Thank you, Inez. Thanks for having me.
No worries. Thank you. And that was Bridget Dunn from Youth Law, who's a senior lawyer who joined me to discuss the adult time for youth crime bills being rushed through Parliament. Bridget works in early intervention crime programs aimed at helping young people involved in the justice system in Australia and internationally.
G'day, Ralph Edwards here from the Concrete Gang, creatures of the industry, and a long-time supporter of 3CR. Next year, the Concrete Gang and 3CR are both going to be 50. 1976, and one of the first shows on 3CR was the Concrete Gang. We're looking for anyone who has some cassette recordings of a Concrete Gang show, anything from 1976 through to 2000 when everything became digitised. We're looking for that material. Whatever you've got, we're interested in getting them digitised and become part of an archive, which is the Concrete Gang 50th Anniversary Archive. Ring 3CR on 9419 8377 during business hours, or come in to 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy, and help us put together the best possible archive we can have of the Concrete Gang. Dare to look, struggle to find, and help us out with the 50th Anniversary Archive of the Concrete Gang. Thank you.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the apartheid-free zone movement.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. You are joining me, who is about to talk to Professor Kate Fitzgibbon and Matt Tyler, who joined me to discuss the Lily James coronial inquest and how the government needs to act on domestic violence and femicide. Now, Kate is a professor at Monash University and a leading international expert on domestic violence and sexual violence, and an expert advisor on the coronial inquest, and gave evidence during the public hearing. Matt Tyler is one of Australia's leading advocates focusing on improving the lives of children and young people as Executive Director of the Men's Project at Jesuit Social Services that leads groundbreaking work to reduce violence and prevent child sexual abuse and promote flourishing amongst men and boys. Now, this segment will discuss issues such as femicide and domestic violence, which can be distressing to some listeners. So you can call for support on 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732, as well as a suicide callback service on 1-300-659-467. Or join us again in 15 minutes at 7:45. But thank you so much for joining us here today, Kate and Matt.
Thanks for having us on.
I wonder if I could direct my first question to Kate, as you gave the expert report to the state coroner about what happened with Lily James and the really unfortunate death and relationship that she was involved in.
Yeah, thanks so much, Anise, and thanks so much for covering this today. As many listeners may remember, in October 2023, Lily James, who was 21 years old, was killed by her former boyfriend, Paul Tyson, who was 24 years old. Paul later that evening died by suicide. And the case has really raised a lot of questions about the risks that were identified following Lily's death in the relationship and the period following relationship separation between Paul and Lily. It's also encouraged a huge conversation, which I think is a really important one across all of Australia, about what we know and what we could be doing to ensure greater safety for young Australians in their intimate partner dating relationships. Paul and Lily had only dated for a very short period of time. The killing occurred at St Andrew's Cathedral School, so it was quite unique in that it occurred in a shared workplace, but also a place where children and young people spend a significant amount of their time, so it's really encouraging some important wider conversations.
Yeah, it's, you know, really, really upsetting and harrowing to listen to that, and I know that, you know, so often with domestic violence statistics, and we hear it so often, and misogyny is such a embedded tapestry throughout our systems that it can be so easy to forget that each of these statistics is a person and how important and all these behaviours that lead up to this. And thank you for sharing about what happened with Lily James. But with Matt Tyler, can I ask you a question about the Adolescent Men's Box report that builds on the research that was completed in 2024 in partnership with Respect Victoria, that had found that over 20% of men aged 18 to 30 believe that if a guy has a girlfriend or a wife, he deserves to know where she is at all times. Could you speak to some of these behaviours and reports that were involved in this?
Ines, thank you. Just echoing Kate, really appreciate your coverage of this inquest, and one of the questions we're asking at Jesuit Social Services is what can we learn from this inquest to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again? And what the coroner's provided us is a really clear set of recommendations as to the need for improved early intervention efforts with boys and young men. That's the focus of our work at Jesuit Social Services. We work across schools, sports clubs, workplaces, and as you're touching on, we've done research to understand what both adult men as well as adolescent boys think about some of the underlying reasons why violence is being used. Our adult man box, which as you said was completed in partnership with Respect Victoria, surveyed 3,500 Australian men aged between 18 and 45. And one of the findings relevant to what has happened with regards to the killing of Lily James is that, yes, 1 in 5 men think it's okay for them to know where their partner is at all times. What we saw in the case of Paul's behaviour is tech-facilitated stalking. And so Paul, over and over again, was checking Lily's location. There was also physical stalking. It's not to say that an improved awareness of this would have prevented Lily's death, but friends of Paul and Lily who were aware of this behaviour responded by sort of thinking, oh, you must really like her. Yeah. And so there's a need for a much more concerted effort to build awareness about how to use location-based application safety safely, applications like SnapMap. And there's also a need for technology companies to design these applications to make sure young people who are using them are aware of who is accessing their location. And so that push, safety by design, is a real obligation on tech companies to do that.
Yeah, thank you so much. And particularly the point of, I guess, bystanders and people mistaking Paul's behaviour as, yeah, romantic or a show of interest.
Yeah.
And I feel like sentiments like that are so often shared amongst a group, and particularly for young people now who maybe, you know, particularly from the pandemic, maybe have lived a lot of their lives online or maybe are becoming more radicalized. But yeah, I guess I'm wondering, what do you believe are some of the factors that are leading into why people believe that this behavior is a show of interest? Is it that, you know, men and boys want to seem tough and confident, and this is what they think that being like a good partner is? Yeah, I'm just hoping if you could talk to us, and then I'll go to Kate.
Yeah, thanks, Inez. A recent piece of work we did, we surveyed 1,400 adolescents, Inez, and it goes to some of the ideas you were just touching on. We wanted to understand the extent to which they endorse ideas like a boy should always appear confident, they should never back down from a challenge. And we surveyed adolescents of all genders, and what we found is that regardless of gender, adolescents are perceiving social pressures on boys to rock up in these stereotypical ways. One of the really bits of good news is that boys were less likely to endorse these ideas themselves, and so they're perceiving social pressures, but they're not actually endorsing these ideas themselves. And probably most importantly, and if there are parents listening, girls don't want boys to be rocking up in this way. They don't want boys to be rocking up as the big dog alpha male with bravado. They want to connect with boys on a much deeper level. And what we find is that boys who do, the small group of boys who do endorse these stereotypical ideas about what it means to be a man, they are more likely to retaliate when rejected. And a big part of what we read in the coroner's findings is that Paul was a young man who had been rejected by Lily, and he wasn't able to deal with that reality. And so we've got to make sure we're engaging boys through respect for relationships education with the reality that they will not always get what they want. They will hear the words no over their journey, and we've got to connect with them on what are the values that they want to live their life by, and engage with them with scenarios as to how are they going to respond when they hear the words no from an intimate partner.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mike. Yeah, very important topic. And, you know, as we've spoken about, it's not just, you know, the two people involved in this scenario that unfortunately have died. It is the entire system and the relationships and the young people and the pressures that are involved in them. And just going on from that, Kate, I know you gave expert witness testimony on the 3-day public hearings of the coronial inquest, and so often the inquest findings, you know, they sit on a shelf, they're recommendations and bullet points that people don't look after again. And I know you really spoke to how we need to act on this. Could you talk to us about, yeah, what were some of the recommendations, not just from, you know, men's violence, but from people, young people to act as bystanders, how to ensure that risk of stalking is recognised? Because so often, you know, you mention, oh, I'm being stalked to the police, and they're like, yeah, we'll come back when you've been killed, basically. Could you talk to a little bit more about that, Kate?
Yeah, absolutely, Inez, and I think this is such an important point. We've already seen a fortnight now pass since the state coroner handed down the inquest findings, and while, of course, consideration takes time, we're yet to see the New South Wales government or any other state and territory governments publicly commit to considering and implementing these findings. They, while they are New South Wales specific, given the jurisdiction of the coroner's court, these findings are absolutely relevant to efforts to address young Australians' safety within their intimate partner relationships in all Australian states and territories. So our hope is certainly that all governments will be looking to this, including the Commonwealth Government, as a way to further their prevention, early intervention efforts under the National Plan to End Violence Against Women and Children. Some of the other recommendations that the coroner made are really tangible, specific one that could be actioned now to ensure that all states and territories have built in the high risk of physical and digital stalking to their risk identification, assessment and management frameworks. We have these frameworks in different forms in every Australian state and territory, and they're used by frontline practitioners to identify and understand where an individual may be at risk of serious harm or even death.
It do you mean, I'm sorry, sorry, before you continue, just with the frameworks, who is using these frameworks? Do you mean like police and ambulance?
Absolutely. So police, GPs, we know a lot of GPs often have an opportunity to identify where someone's experiencing abuse, emergency workers, specialist family violence practitioners, people who are providing access to housing, alcohol and drug programs. So it can really be specialist as well as generalist workers. We also know that teachers play a really important role, particularly when we're thinking about young Australians. So it's really important that we upskill and task teachers with being able to talk about some of these critical issues. And I think that's where that second recommendation around bystander interventions goes to. The coroner's spoken about the importance of ensuring that young people can identify problematic behaviours not only in themselves, but also in and amongst their peers, and that they have the skills to call out that behaviour where they do identify it and to do so safely.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And yeah, it's so important to recognise that, you know, sometimes stalking is not always seen as, you know, as a as the highest escalation of threat, but so often, as we've seen also in this case, that it is the indication of the highest form of risk and escalation in violence, particularly of intimate partner homicide, and you should definitely not go undetected. Unfortunately, we are running out of time. I'm sure I could talk to you both about the importance of this issue for so long. But I'm wondering, yeah, just to wrap up, if Kate and Matt, could you tell us, yeah, if people want to learn more about how to have respectful relationships, how do I stand up for my friend? What do I do if I'm experiencing this? Yeah, Kate, would you mind telling us if our listeners are listening?
I'm sure Matt will be able to point to a range of resources, particularly around the adolescent man box. On your second point there, Innes, I'd just say if anyone is listening to this and is concerned about behaviour that they're experiencing or the safety of a friend, if that is an immediate risk, you should absolutely call the police. If you are wanting advice on your own safety or the safety of a friend, helplines like 1-800-RESPECT are a fantastic starting point. You'll be connected with a specialist counsellor who can talk you through those issues.
And there's just to build on what Kate shared, a couple of things. First, one of the findings from the coroner is the need for the promotion of help seeking amongst men and boys who are at risk of harming others. And so if you're someone listening who's got concerns about your own behaviour, call the Men's Referral Service, 1300 76491. And then secondly, one of the really positive findings from this study is that adolescents told us that parents are a really significant influence on their life, given the, you know, the current national conversation around boys' online lives. There's understandable fear about boys going down online rabbit warrens, but parents really matter. And so if you're a parent who wants to know more, Google the Adolescent Man Box, and there's a range of information in that report that could really help you to start to engage your adolescent boy in a conversation about some of these issues.
Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us on a really important issue and for, yeah, bringing awareness to the life of Lily James as well.
Thanks
so much, Inez.
Thank you. And that was Professor Kate Fitzgibbon and Matt Tyler, who joined me to discuss Lily James' coronial inquest and how the government needs to act on femicide and domestic violence. Kate is a professor at Monash University and a leading international expert on domestic family and sexual violence, and Matt Taylor is one of Australia's leading advocates and the executive director of the Men's Project at Jesuit Social Services. Now, again, this segment discussed family, domestic violence and femicide, which can be distressing to some listeners. For support, you can call 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737-732 or Suicide Callback Service on 1-300-659-467, as well as the Men's Referral Service, and if you are in immediate danger, to call 000. If you're experiencing family violence, free legal support is available. You may need support with obtaining protection, setting up safe parenting arrangements, organising a new visa, getting into safe housing, or making sure bills and bank accounts are split fairly. Community legal centres have expertise in helping people who experience family violence and can provide confidential advice to help you understand your rights and legal options. Reach out today for guidance and support. Visit www.fclc.org.au and click Get Help to find a community legal centre near you. You don't have to face family violence alone. If you're currently in crisis, please contact Safe Steps on 1800 015 188. Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your app.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And now I am so happy to welcome one of this year's Eureka Medal recipients, Vasalia Govenda, who was awarded the medal last week in recognition of her long-term advocacy work as the founder of the Injured Workers Support Team, or IWST. IWST is a grassroots community network providing human-centred support to people navigating Victoria's complicated workers' comp system. And today, Vasalia joins us to share more about IWST's most recent campaign. Good morning, Vasalia.
Good morning, Leila. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for joining us. So first and foremost, Vasalia, could you introduce what is the Injured Workers Support Team? What do you actually do and why was it formed?
So the Injured Workers Support Team is a volunteer Facebook group. And what we do is we actually provide support and assistance to any injured worker that's navigating the workers' comp system. From, you know, providing advice after you've been injured at work to helping you fill in a work cover claim form. If the claim's rejected, we help you to put in a request to the Workplace Injury Commission and navigate that, requesting for services. Now we've also included representation at arbitration. Hmm. Why we do what we do? I think it's just about the passion. You know, no injured worker should lose their job, their income, their home, or be stripped of their dignity because they've been injured at work. So what we're trying to do is put the accountability and responsibility back into the system and make sure that injured workers don't lose their rights and entitlements.
Thank you, Vasalia. I wanted to go back to some really basic context, which, you know, a lot of people might not know, especially if the workers' comp system kind of complicates it in an unnecessary way. What actually is a workplace injury, and can you always see them?
So a workplace injury is any injury, physical or psychosocial, that happens at work. From a scratch to a fractured, a broken leg, a head injury, to anxiety and depression because of workplace bullying that hasn't been controlled, mm-hmm. workload that hasn't been managed. So any injury where work is the significant contributing factor is a workplace injury.
Yeah, okay. And now I'm wondering, how does a person actually claim workers' compensation? Can any worker claim workers' compensation, including casual workers or sole traders?
Any worker, as long as you are being paid a salary by someone else, you claim workers' comp. It works differently if you're self-employed, but anyone that gets injured during the course of employment puts in a work cover claim. My number one advice to any worker is if you, not just when you get injured, but even if you have a near miss, report it, whether it's using the employer's hazard reporting scheme or sending a text message or an email, report that. Because when you put in a work cover claim, the one of the question is, did you notify your employer of the injury? Yes, I did. So I can go to work today, you know, have a fall, but no injury. Two weeks later, I could end up with a serious injury and need an operation. And if I had recorded that in my employer's injury notification database today, then in 2 weeks when I need to take time off work, I'm covered.
Right. That's really important advice. So to get it in writing when it happens, even if it seems insignificant at the time, is crucial to having a successful claim.
Yep. And so when you are submitting a claim, you download the claim form or your employer would give it to you. And we actually have masterclasses on our IWST through a Zoom link. And we teach people about information that you need to attach because the WorkSafe agent has 28 days to make a decision.
Yeah.
So if you give them not just the medical information, but a timeline event of what had happened, identify how that you know, that's a workplace risk that wasn't managed or controlled, you have a higher success rate of getting the claim accepted.
Now, Vasalia, what is the focus of IWST's latest campaign and how can people support it?
So I'm not sure if your listeners are aware that last year, this government rushed in changes to the Workplace Injury Rehabilitation Compensation Act in Victoria. Two significant changes is one, you know, psychosocial claims are being rejected on the grounds that it is, you know, normal and acceptable to be bullied and harassed at work and suffer from anxiety and depression. That's my opinion of what I see the changes. And the second one is that if you're an injured worker, to remain on workers' comp after 130 weeks, you need to have a WPI of 20% or more. The issue with that is what the government didn't
just
take into
sorry,
Vasalia,
would you be able to clarify what a WPI is?
Whole person impairment.
Okay, thank you.
So they have a rating scale and they'll assess your injury accordingly, and you must have 20% or more in order to continue with weekly payments. The issue with that is they don't consider things like, you know, the delay. Why is someone on 130 weeks? They, you know, the workers' comp system is you get injured, you get the medical treatment, you get rehabilitation and you return to work. But the problem is, you know, just to run a dispute at the Workplace Injury Commission, you're waiting 6 months. To have a matter taken to a medical panel, you're waiting 6 months. This is what's contributing to injured workers staying on the system longer. Our government didn't even, you know, explore that, and they brought in these changes that punishes injured workers. So what we've done is we've been, you know, trying to get the minister to sit down with us, and that is Ben Carroll, the Minister for Workplace, and have a conversation with him about this. He wouldn't listen to us. So we've been forced to run a petition to actually claw back those changes. And the reason for that is that our government, in my opinion, has broken the workers' comp system and workers are being punished for that.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of convolutions to people actually receiving the support they need. How can people get help from IWST and what is the best way to get in touch with you?
So we do have a Facebook group. I actually don't actually advertise IWST because I'm the only volunteer in the group that actually does the representation.
Yeah, I see.
So What we do is people can join our Facebook group, and when they do, we encourage them to put up their questions in the group itself, and then they'll get some help from the other injured workers. And if they can't through that way, then only will I step in and go and represent someone.
Right.
So this is another issue as well we're facing, that this legislation doesn't allow for lived experience when making decisions about changes to workers' comp. And the second most important thing is that there is no advocacy to help someone manage the and navigate the claim system. You know, as an injured worker, you must have a degree to learn workers' comp. If you don't have a knowledge, how are you going to navigate the system? How do you know what your rights and entitlements are?
Yeah, it sounds like the peer support system is really crucial to the work of IWST. My final question for today, Vasalia, can anyone with an interest become a volunteer? And what can listeners do to support the work that you do?
So to support the work that I do, I would want people to please, please go onto the work petition on the Victorian Government website. I can also send that to you to put that up on your webpage. We need to have those signatures. For people who have experience in workers' comp and want to volunteer and take on a role to provide peer support, all they do is just send me an email at iwst.help@gmail.com.
Vasalia, thank you so much for joining us this morning, and thank you for the important support that you're providing to injured workers. I hope you have a great day.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. This is Thursday Breakfast, and you just heard from one of this year's Eureka Medal recipients, Vasalia Govenda, who is the founding member of the Injured Workers Support Team, or IWST.
And if you are just joining us, earlier in the show, we heard from Bridget Dunn, a senior lawyer at Youth Law, who joined Inez to talk about the Adult Time for Youth Crime Bill and the impacts that that has on the whole of life for young people. And then we were joined by Professor Kate Fitzgibbon and Matt Tyler to discuss Lily James' coronial inquest and the importance of government attention on femicide and domestic violence. And again, if you did want to speak to somebody about any of the themes that were raised in that interview, you can call 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737-732. You can call Lifeline on 131114 and the Suicide Callback Service on 1-300-659-467. It is 7:57 in the morning.
Hi,
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
I'm joined now by Munstazi from Resident Frequency Studio to discuss Rave for the Towers, a day of music and food by the community for the community in solidarity with the 44 towers facing eviction.
Good morning, everyone. How are we?
Thanks for joining us. How are you going?
Yeah, good, good. It's very important for Resident Frequency. It's our second album that we're launching. It's part of Neighbourhood House, Collingwood. We also have Neighbourhood House in Richmond as well. All the artists are doing it for free, right? So come on down and enjoy it. It's next Friday. Starts at 4 to 8. There's a massive lineup of people.
Yeah. Tell me a bit more about Resident Frequency.
Well, Resident Frequency was started by the youth.
Mm.
So the youth had nothing better to do. So let's start making music. And we were lucky that Neighbourhood House said yes. So they started building a studio. We got a lot of help from outside people. Chris from the Wellington. He was great when it came to sound and everything else. Monkey Mark.
Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah, so there was a lot of us that put a lot of time in there. Nick from Food Not Bombs.
Yeah.
Got in as well. So we all got behind the kids. And all of a sudden they become young adults. And we launched an album last year around the same time.
Yeah.
And this is now the second album. So it's starting to get a bit of a following, a bit of a build-up.
It's very exciting. I mean, these are also names that you now see around the, you know, the wider city circuit. It must be pretty proud to see this project really blow up like this.
Yeah, look, we're extremely proud of them all. The guys get in behind us. Any other functions that we do for council and everything else, they get behind us and get out there and sing live. So the whole idea of it all is, instead of sitting at home being depressed and you're playing your guitar and singing tunes, come on down to the recording studio.
Yeah.
Let's record you. We do master the tracks through Monkey Mark.
Do you do any songwriting, help and stuff like that?
We do that.
As much as the person.
Yeah, we will help the person as much as possible. Collaborations together.
That's really cool.
So we've done quite a few collaborations. So this year's lineup, we've got Elijah, his First Nation, also Jody, another First Nation, Curly, another First Nation.
Wonderful.
So that's awesome. We've got Combat Wombat.
Hell yeah.
We've got Eagle versus Drone, which is Izzy again. Got Moon Starzy, we got Marley, Abraham, got Hank from 3CR.
Yeah, shout out Hank.
So, 3CR back us a lot. Resident Frequency also have a show on today, every Thursday, 12 to 1.
Mm.
So what we're doing is trying to get out there in the community and get people back into singing. It helps with depression, helps with mental health, and it's better than sitting alone.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it's really easy to find unhealthy ways to spend your time, especially as a kid, you know.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of that, good idea. I think Campbell might come down and DJ too.
Oh, wonderful.
So he's about 12 years old.
Yeah, that's so sick.
So we let everyone get involved. We don't turn people away.
Yeah.
And what it is to help someone, better themselves with what's going on around the world and all over Australia as well. We need as many hands as possible to make it a better place.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we can't leave it up to one person and say, well, hey guys, you mucked up.
Mm.
Yeah, we've all got to play a role in as well. So it's not a rave, but we just like that word of having so many different artists out there, different styles of music. There is a lot of hip-hop in it, and the lyrics are all meaningful to the problems and issues we're having today.
Mm.
So, it's a great turnout. It's in Harmsworth Park, so it's open for everyone. But I think we might sneak in a 2 o'clock start.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Moon Starzy might DJ early. Yeah.
Insider info.
I was just going to say, it is so awesome the work that you're doing, because for folks that aren't familiar, this is down at the Collingwood Flats, yeah?
Correct, yeah. Thank you.
So this is for people that are in the flats, who live there.
Correct.
And young folks in the flats as well, to be able to raise their voices through this program.
Yeah, we've also done tracks with the Collingwood College as well. So Izzy workshopped over there. With one of the music teachers, brought the kids over to the studio, and I must say they were quicker than us adults. In an hour she put through 20 kids, recorded them all, and made an awesome track out of it. So, think miracles can happen. We don't have all the latest gear and everything else, but it works.
Mm.
That's the main thing.
Yeah, that's a really wonderful little project that's come up. It's so nice to be able to celebrate it with a full day together as well.
Oh, it is. Look, it's open to families. It's open to everyone. So no one gets turned away. It's about relaxing. Please no alcohol in the park.
Hmm.
because we'd like to do this again. You know, and what it is it's for the community, by the community. You know, so come down, there's food there, the music be there, there's people to talk to, and just enjoy the day.
Yeah.
Let's go back to old school, I say.
Well, I think especially after, you know, quite a rough year for public housing, I think it's nice to maybe have a little sort of bright thing to end it on.
Yeah, and that's why Rave for the Towers come up. We also back those in community housing to make it transparent for yous all. I'm also in community housing. Most of us are. And what we want to do is just make sure you're safe. You understand what's going on. And, you know, it's okay to have a bit of a breakdown and a cry because it's your home. But you're losing your community. That's the worst part.
Yeah.
So someone you might have been living next to for 20 years, now you lose contact. And then there's the services on top, which isn't very good. But so this is here as a day to let go of all that, reset yourself. It's before Christmas. There's a lot of us don't celebrate it, but it's time to come together. Time to show we can stand strong together.
Yeah. Have a lovely time with it. I was wondering if you could just remind us again the details of the event.
Okay. Rave for the Towers, Resident Frequency Studio Artists, 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. Friday 19th of this month, Harmsworth Park, Collingwood. There'll be music. There's food by the community. The great lineup: Elijah Kanani, Race Rage, Eagle versus Drain, Combat Wombat, Moonstarzy, Jody Beaton, Marley, Abraham, Hank, Curly, and also Minnie.
Yeah.
She's another 3CR. So there's a lot of us that all do music, all do our radio live.
Oh, shout out to Curly, though, because Curly's got the Cultural Kinetics show on 3CR too. So you got three, at least four people from 3CR.
Yeah, so I think what we might do is we might record it as well. We might even have someone roaming around asking you how you are. You know, if you don't want to talk to them, that's fine. But if you do, you know, just have a big shout out. Even if it's a shout out to your family.
Yeah.
So come down and enjoy it.
Yeah, sounds like it'll be wonderful. Thanks for joining us today.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. Have a great day.
And that was Moonstarzy, who's joining us from the Resident Frequency Studio to talk about Rave for the Towers, a day of music and food by the community, for the community, in solidarity with the 44 Flats, from 4 to 8 p.m. on Friday, the 19th of December at Harmsworth Park in Collingwood. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 8:07 in the morning.
The Electronic Intifada is Palestine's weapon of mass instruction.
Netanyahu's at the zenith of his genocidal career.
These people committed atrocities.
This is a war on children, essentially.
Tune into Electronic Intifada Radio for interviews, reports, and analysis. Thursdays at 7 p.m. on 855 AM, 3CR Digital, and online at 3cr.org.au.
This is starvation. Time is running out.
Quando sono solo in casa e solo devo restare.
Benvenuti, benvenuti al programma Radio Filet.
Mercoledì pomeriggio dalle 18:30 alle 19:30.
And for those who don't speak Italian, that's Wednesday evening, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m.
You'll hear from multi-generational Italian voices coming together to connect and learn and discuss Italian culture.
And politics.
And politics.
Radio File, building bridges between the diaspora.
The program will be part in Italian, part in English, so...
Practice your Italian or hone your listening skills.
Radio File, la voce alternativa della comunità italiana a Melbourne.
Tune in to 3CR, 855 AM, or you can listen online, 3cr.org.au.
Radio Filef.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that.
addressed it if we're serious about this.
Move over or we gonna move on over you.
Yillaman, with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR, dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1pm.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 8:10 in the morning, and we are now joined by Kristen O'Connell, spokesperson for the Anti-Poverty Centre, who's speaking with us about the second report by the Commonwealth Ombudsman in its investigation into the Targeted Compliance Framework, otherwise known as mutual obligations, where welfare recipients are subjected to a regime of compulsory activities in order to access Social Security payments. The report, which was published on Tuesday this week, covers the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations' approach to remediation for unlawfully suspended payments, which the Ombudsman has described as neither fair nor reasonable. We will have a link to the report in our show notes. But for now, good morning, Kristen.
Hi, Priya. How are you doing?
I'm going all right. How are you?
Tired after this week.
Yeah, it's been a very, very big week, and I was hoping that you could maybe start setting the scene by describing some of the organizations and what they do in terms of the vast network of folks that are involved in this system of targeted compliance, just so that our audience has a bit of an anchor for all the acronyms. So can you take us through the respective roles of the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations, Services Australia, and employment service providers in administering the Targeted Compliance Framework or mutual obligations?
Yes, definitely. And there are also some more organisations who weren't mentioned in the Ombudsman's report but are also involved. So I guess the ultimate responsibility for the compulsory activities, how they are translated from law into practice, is supposed to sit with the employment department. They have carriage of all of the things like the technology platforms that people have to use to submit job applications, to log the points, to check how many demerits they might have accrued if they've been given a penalty by a provider. There's also the Department of Social Services, because one quarter of the people who have to do these compulsory activities are actually in a separate program that's supposed to target disabled people. It's not a better program, but it does just sit in a different department. DUA also runs a complaints line for people to complain about providers, but DSS also has a separate complaints line. People can use either of these complaints lines. Services Australia is supposed to apply payment reductions and cancellations if a person has accrued too many demerits, and they're also responsible for something called a capability interview, where once a person is getting towards the point where they might receive a financial penalty, Services Australia is supposed to check whether the job plan requirements they've been given by a provider are actually feasible for them to complete. Services Australia also has some responsibility for reviewing decisions that a person might want to challenge. And they also do something else that I've forgotten because they do so many things. And then we also have just a related program administered by the National Indigenous Australians Agency, specifically for people in remote areas, targeting primarily First Nations people. And the current version of that program is called the Remote Area Employment Service. And finally, we have the employment services providers, who are the ones that most people have to deal with. They are privately run organisations. It's an outsourced system, and it costs around $4 billion a year. And ultimately, those providers, their role is to police people. It is to enforce compliance. There is very little done to actually assist people in getting into paid work if that's what they're looking for, although there is some bullying sometimes to push people into paid work, even if it's not suitable for them. So obviously there's a lot more detail there, but that's probably the most condensed version I can give of all of that. Oh, and most importantly, those providers are responsible for making decisions under social security law about whether a person has been compliant with the requirements the provider themselves have set. And if a person is not compliant, the provider suspends their Centrelink payment.
Yeah, I mean, it is a massively convoluted system interconnected across several different departments. But the crucial thing to note there, as you said, is that these private providers do have the ability to suspend people's payments, and that's a delegated authority that they have, which is the focus of the Commonwealth Ombudsman's investigation. And the Commonwealth Ombudsman announced this investigation into the targeted compliance framework in February this year, and it published its first report in August, which revealed the scale of unlawful income support cancellations by Dewar and Services Australia between April 2022 and July 2024. And this week's report further delves into Dewar's remediation approach. So can you take us through what the Ombudsman has been considering in this part of the investigation?
And also just to add, I mean, the first report did look at about 960 cancellations that were confirmed and admitted to by the Employment Department at that time. However, there are unknown number of cancellations that haven't yet been publicly disclosed based on some modelling from the peak body for community legal centres who work with welfare recipients. There's at least 300,000 in under one piece of social security law. The department's also admitted to an extra 8,000. So there's a big question mark over how many there are. In terms of what the department has decided to do for that small group of 900, they are claiming they're running a compensation scheme. We argue not a compensation scheme because the primary aim for them is just to back pay people for the period they would have received their, whether it's an unemployment payment, disability support, pension or parenting payment, to kind of just give them that money, but not to do any meaningful compensation. They have given people the option to initiate a process to seek additional compensation for financial damage. So, for example, if you had an overdue phone bill because of this and you got a $15 late fee, that's the kind of thing you could seek financial compensation for. You could potentially also seek compensation if you had a debt or some sort of other financial ramification of having had your payment reduced or cancelled. What they have done is work very hard to exclude people from accessing any meaningful compensation for the stress and the time wasting and the psychological harm that they might have experienced because of these payment cancellations. And the Ombudsman has highlighted that he thinks that's not appropriate and that that sort of compensation should be available to people. But ultimately, a big problem with this scheme is that it is hard for people to know that they are entitled to it. About 600 people have been automatically back paid, but another 300 odd haven't. And a very small number of those have come forward to access their back pay. And so far, I believe it was zero or one person has sought additional financial compensation. And they have created a really intensive process for people to do that, where you would have to go back and could be going back many years to find documents that prove that you had a financial harm caused to you as a result of not receiving your Centrelink payment.
Yeah, I mean, you've really laid out the sort of massive administrative burden that gets put onto welfare recipients who are challenging this system. And so what were some of the key issues that the Ombudsman was scrutinising here?
Well, there's a lot in this report. I think one of the things that we wanted to point out is that while the Ombudsman didn't have the scope or the resources to go and look directly at how providers are operating, he did look at how the department kind of has oversight or doesn't have oversight of what they do. And so he noted that there is a very high number of payment suspensions that are reversed, and that obviously shows that in many cases it's possible the person did not, in fact, do the wrong thing. They may have actually fulfilled a requirement that was then marked as not fulfilled, or alternatively, they were given a requirement that they didn't complete, but it was not appropriate in the first place. And he pointed out something that the Anti-Poverty Centre has pointed out for a long time, that if this many decisions are being reversed, it's clear you have a systemic problem, even if we're not quite clear on the details of how that problem is occurring at this stage. We know that there is a lack of information in the IT systems that the department has about a lot of these payment suspensions. And the minister also talked about a lack of evidence for some of these decisions, which makes them very hard to review. Mm. So we have millions of suspension notices being issued a year, about 2.7 million. We have well over a million, more like 1.5 million people having their payment delayed because of those payment suspensions. And at the moment, we know there are big gaps in the information that is held about whether anyone could even verify whether those were lawfully applied.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it is important to put a fine point on the fact that it is not an onerous process for a provider to suspend a payment, but on the other hand, it is an incredibly onerous process for people to then try and get their payments reinstated.
That's right. It is a literal tick box for the provider, and to the extent that sometimes a person will talk about they attended an appointment and then they get a notification right after the appointment saying that they have not attended and that therefore their payment is on hold. That is because the provider has just ticked the wrong box. So sometimes it's not fully malicious, it's just incompetence. But then, of course, the person, even when there's not an attempt to bully them with these tools, has to try and contact their worker. It can often be very difficult to do that. So people actually trying to get in contact with these providers often don't have any direct line, no email address, no phone number for the person who's responsible for marking these activities completed, have to sit on hold for a very long time. It might get through to a call centre who isn't willing to fix the problem and then have very burdensome internal processes with those providers to lodge a complaint if they want to do it that way. So that's just, you know, not to mention the stress that you get the moment you get that text message, knowing that you're going to have to jump through those hoops, find the time to do those things, which a lot of people don't have, and ultimately potentially have to wait on hold for hours to the due complaint line if the provider fails or refuses to resolve the unfair penalty or unlawful penalty that they've applied.
Mm. And I mean, you know, you can't emphasize enough, people cannot afford to have these payments suspended. Yeah. These payments are below the poverty line anyway, and having a suspension or cancellation of payments has serious impacts on people's lives that, you know, ripple out in so many different directions. And as you've mentioned, you know, the minimal and very challenging compensation process doesn't really account for the whole of life impacts of a payment suspension. Now, the Ombudsman's report, the second report, has made 8 recommendations and 1 suggestion on the basis of this part of its investigation into the targeted compliance framework. And all of these have been accepted by Dewar and Services Australia. First of all, how do these recommendations align with demands from the Anti-Poverty Centre? And to what extent are these acceptances by the agencies enforceable or monitored?
So the Ombudsman has said he will be monitoring the department's kind of follow through on those recommendations, although he doesn't actually have the power to force them to do things, to my knowledge. With the recommendations themselves, we would say that they are quite weak. They will not address the systemic problems that exist in this system, but the Ombudsman is also limited in his power to make stronger recommendations. So the most important things in this report are his findings, the information he has exposed, and the commentary that he's provided. But the recommendations include sort of making tweaks that I guess might make sense if you assume that this system has not been working as it was designed to work. Things like adjusting the amount of time people have to try and stop a payment suspension being applied if they've received one of those notices, putting their payment on hold. This has already been done and it hasn't slowed down the rate of suspensions. In fact, in the most recent quarter, while the Ombudsman's investigation was going on, while all these providers knew their scrutiny was happening or should have known, payment suspension notices issued increased by a quarter. So we went from about 504,000 payment suspension notices in the June quarter to 618,000 notices issued by providers in the September quarter. So giving someone a few more days to call up and say, please don't actually delay my payment because there was this reason, but it didn't happen, doesn't, you know, it's very clear that that is not going to change provider behaviour. Mm. There's some monitoring tools that the department has said that they're going to put in place There's really nothing there to give people any expectation that we would see systemic change. And ultimately, we have always argued at the Anti-Poverty Centre, alongside the Unemployed Workers Union and other organisations, that compulsion has to be scrapped. Mm-hmm. The system cannot be treating people with respect while it is given the tools to take away people's social security payment, which is a human rights violation, and to ultimately have a system that is designed by welfare recipients and unemployed people to work for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you've said, even if it is not a malicious act, it functions in a punitive way because of the way that the system is designed. And just to wrap up, Kristen, is there any advice or information that you'd like to share with our listeners who are impacted by mutual obligations?
Yes, absolutely. If you are having an issue with your provider, with the complaints process at the department, with Services Australia, any part of this system, or if you are concerned that you may have been affected by an unlawful payment cancellation, an unlawful payment suspension in the past, please do contact us. We have an email address. It's help@welfarecopwatch.org.au. And so that is us policing the police. So we are looking for, A, to try and support people. We are encouraging people to submit Freedom of Information requests, requests to Services Australia and for their provider records to identify if they've had unlawful penalties applied. So we have a template for that that we can provide to people if they contact us via help@welfarecopwatch.org.au.
And we will include that information in our show notes as well. Thank you so much, Kristen, for your time.
Thank you very much, Priya.
And that was Kristen O'Connell, spokesperson for the Anti-Poverty Centre, who joined us to break down the second report by the Commonwealth Ombudsman in its investigation into the Targeted Compliance Framework, otherwise known as Mutual Obligations. And we will have that information about how to contact Anti-Poverty Centre and seek support in navigating this system in our show notes, as well as a link to the full report. And a disclosure for me, I'm also a member of Anti-Poverty Centre. It's always a pleasure to speak with Kristen, and I think this is a vital topic to be covering. And we will be back to you shortly with a little wrap-up before we say goodbye for another week. 3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast, and this morning on the show we heard firstly from Bridget Dunn, who is a senior lawyer at Youth Law, speaking to Inez about the Adult Time for Youth Crime Bill. After that, we heard from Kate Fitzgibbon and Matt Tyler, who joined us to discuss the Lily James coronial inquest and how the government needs to act on femicide and domestic violence now. Then we heard from Vasalia Govenda, who is the founder of the Injured Workers Support Team, and Vasalia spoke to us a bit more about the IWST's most recent campaign.
And then after that, we were joined in the studio by Moon Starzy from Resident Frequency Studio, who discussed the Rave for the Towers event, which will be happening next Friday, the 19th of December at Harmsworth Park in Collingwood from 4 to 8 p.m., although he did say that they might sneakily start at 2 p.m., so TBC. And Kristen O'Connell finally joined us from Anti-Poverty Centre to break down the second report by the Commonwealth Ombudsman on mutual obligations, and in particular looking at the remediation process for people who've had their payments suspended. That's all we've got time for this week on Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 8:55 a.m. But we will catch you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.